WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson in for Brian today. On today's show, it looks like a war zone. And that's been a common response to the searing images out of Ferguson, Missouri. The militarization of police there and across the country now coming under some harsh scrutiny. Also being scrutinized recently, the handling of sexual assault on college campuses. New policies at some New York schools. Are they enough? A video appears to show the execution of an American journalist by the militant group that's been sweeping across Iraq. Plus, what Google searches across the country reveal about income inequality. There are two Americas online as well. But first, the events in Ferguson had largely pushed the case of Eric Garner out of the spotlight. But yesterday, Staten Island District Attorney Daniel Donovan announced a grand jury investigation into Garner's death. 43-year-old Garner died last month after being put in a chokehold by police during an arrest for selling untaxed cigarettes. The city medical examiner ruled Garner's death a homicide, and the Reverend Al Sharpton and other advocates have called for a federal investigation, suggesting that the Staten Island DA couldn't be counted on to carry out a thorough probe. But even as activists plan a protest march this weekend on Staten Island, there's striking news on the issue of stop and frisk. New numbers show the use of the tactic dropped as much as 99% in parts of Brooklyn compared to last year, apparently fulfilling one of Mayor de Blasio's promises. Joining us to sort through all this is Murray Weiss, criminal justice editor for DNA Info. Murray, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics here, and let's talk about why a grand jury has been impaneled in this case. People might be used to the idea of someone gets arrested and charged. What happens with a grand jury investigation, and why that in this case?
Well, normally a district attorney who gets the evidence in a case early on and over the handful of days can make a decision on a police-involved shooting, whether there's a cause to arrest someone, or they can choose to present the evidence to a grand jury. Generally, that's a little bit of a way of letting a panel of peers decide whether a crime may have been committed. The district attorney of Staten Island has chosen that path. It's not uncommon, certainly, in any incidents that involve police shootings.
So who's on a grand jury, and what do we know anything about this particular one that will be impaneled?
Well, you're going to have 23 seated people. They're all going to be Staten Island residents. There are some people who might say that a grand jury investigating a police shooting on Staten Island might favor the police a little bit because Staten Island is a community that has a lot of police officers. Versus other boroughs that have more minority communities and a different sense about the police. But it'll be Staten Island residents, 23 chosen to sit, and the district attorney will begin to present all the evidence in the case, which obviously will range from the videotape, which everybody's seen, that's extraordinarily dramatic, and is going to play an enormous role in this case. They're also going to present, obviously, the medical findings, and there's an array of other interviews that will be presented from witnesses. You'll hear accounts also from perhaps some of the police officers will testify, whether the exact ones who were directly involved in this tragedy are going to speak on their behalf so the grand jury can hear their story before determining whether there's enough evidence that there may have been a crime and that the evidence should now go before a formal jury. And there should be a trial at which, you know, there'll be a determination of whether they've been convicted of a crime.
And we should say, you mentioned the concern in some quarters that a grand jury on Staten Island might be more sympathetic to the police than in other places. Daniel Donovan, the district attorney, seemed to be anticipating that criticism yesterday when he issued a statement saying very forcefully that he would follow the evidence wherever it leaded and he would do a thorough investigation, right?
Yes, I think, you know, Dan Donovan has a very distinguished background. He was a prosecutor in Manhattan for a number of years under Robert Morgenthau before he became the district attorney of Staten Island. He at one time was the president of the District Attorneys Associations of the state of New York. Nobody's really questioning his integrity here. I think he'll make a fair presentation. I think this case is going to hinge on several elements. Obviously, the video is extremely disturbing. And seeing police take actions against citizens is often not, as Police Commissioner Bratton says, not a pretty picture. And one in which a man is dying while he's saying he's not breathing is going to be extraordinarily powerful. It's hard, actually, for me to imagine that the grand jury will not indict the police officers. However, it depends a great deal on the autopsy and perhaps Mr. Garner's health when the medical people showed up, whether he in fact was breathing and to what contribution the lack of, if there was, a lack of medical care contributed to his death. That would go a long way to helping the police officers, in fact, and if they can demonstrate that the tactics they used were basically in line with the kind of police tactics they're taught.
Now, I know that the New York Times certainly quoted some, you know, legal experts on this issue, saying that they felt it was highly unlikely that that the grand jury would indict an officer, certainly on maybe the highest possible charge. Although it might be more likely for an indictment on something like criminally negligent homicide, something like that.
Well, that certainly makes sense. I mean, nobody's suggesting that four officers went out that day to kill Mr. Garner, which would be a murder case. They're performing an act, police action, in accordance with their job. Whether they were violating police guidelines and should have done something different, and whether it elevates to a crime, he died, so the logical count would be some sort of negligent homicide. That, say, for example, when Mr. Garner was saying he couldn't breathe, was there something they were doing or could have done differently?
And listeners, the phones are open if you have questions for Murray Weiss, Justice Editor at DNA Info, either about this grand jury that's been impaneled in the Garner case or about the sharp drop in stop and frisk, which we'll be talking about in a moment. 212-433-WNYC. It's 212-433-9692. The City Medical Examiner did rule the Eric Garner death a homicide, and I know a lot of people have been asking in the Michael Brown case in Ferguson why it's taken this long for there to be an investigation or a charge. And of course, this is the first time there's been a formal investigation or certainly the first grand jury impanelment in the Eric Garner case, even after that ruling of homicide. Do you have any thoughts on why it took this long, or maybe you don't think it's that long at all?
Actually, I'm a little surprised at how quickly they're doing a grand jury in Missouri. Obviously, the case there, it's taken less time to go to grand jury than the one here in New York. But that's probably a good thing now, because it'll begin to calm down maybe some of the tension to know that the legal process is beginning to move there. Some of the difficulties in Missouri versus New York was the lack of information that was publicly put out by officials. No one had to even defend the police officer, but there were some basic facts they should have put out. Things about how many times a weapon was fired, and perhaps where how many times the victim was hit, and even perhaps a suggestion of the events of the evening that started with the robbery in the cigar store. I mean, in the store. So of the cigars.
Mm-hmm.
All of that plays into at least giving the public some answers to what may have transpired, and you admit what you don't have. Also a big problem, obviously, there versus New York is their police force is basically a white police force in a state that has a long history of police issues versus African Americans. And in here in New York, the police department in this city has spent decades trying to get a police force that is more reflective of the people it serves.
Do you think that the events in Ferguson have had an impact on the way that folks here view the Eric Garner case? Do you think that it's had an impact perhaps on District Attorney Donovan's decision to impanel a grand jury?
Well, I would like to think not. I think what it may have an impact on is the number of people who come to a march this weekend. Had the incident in Missouri not happened, you know, passions may have stayed at a reasonable level here in New York. I'm not saying that they're going to get out of control. I actually believe that, you know, our city, the police here actually, I believe, are enjoying a little bit of the residual benefits of some of the terrific work they've done to fight crime in New York and bringing it down. And obviously, some of the major issues now stem from over-policing in a safe city. Obviously, the stop and frisk and too many quality of life have, in certain neighborhoods, have really agitated people, that the police department didn't alter its tactics once they kind of, quote-unquote, won the war on crime in New York. But I think it has some impact. I mean, this is a significant story in Missouri. It touches on a national nerve of you know, the inherent racial issues that are involved in policing in across this country.
I want to go to Hector in Old Tappan, New Jersey, who I think has a specific question about the Garner case and moving forward in the criminal justice system. Hector, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, with regards to the chokehold, whether it's legal or not, I mean, the Anthony Baez incident several years back outlined and outlawed the procedure of chokehold. Why is this even in question anymore?
Murray Weiss, of criminal justice editor at DNA Info, the chokehold is outlawed in the NYPD, I think, since the 90s. Is that right?
It's a tactic that is prohibited in the police department, but the use of it is not, you know, a statewide crime. Using a chokehold isn't in and of itself a crime. That's why it's an issue. And frankly, I'm going to take a step a little farther here. I've talked to a lot of people about the video. You know, the police commissioner is on record saying it appears to be a chokehold, but, you know, I talked to a lot of police tactician people, and a number of them say that what happened in that video is not a chokehold. And I'm only pointing that out to say that that's the kind of testimony a grand jury might hear, and certainly you're going to hear that at a trial. They're going to take the video and break it down and try to explain what physically is happening there and whether in fact it is a chokehold.
I want to play a clip here of Patrick Lynch. He's the president of the Police Benevolent Association, and he, is, of course, has been out there with a lot of press conferences since the Garner death that have been, you know, very combative and defensive of his officers. But with the announcement of the grand jury, I think he took a really different tone, and in fact, said that he welcomed the grand jury investigation. Here he is.
That the decision by the grand jury is based on the facts in the case, not a motion on the street or a story that's told in a hallway and then gets out onto a street corner. We want it based on just the facts of what happened that day.
Murray Weiss, do you sense that there's been a change there, that the Police Benevolent Association, Patrick Lynch, are sort of welcoming this grand jury and think that the facts will come out that way? And what do you ascribe that to?
Well, I think he was faced with two issues. One was at the early stages was clearly the video, as we all know, is an extremely disturbing snapshot of what happened. And he has to defend his members and explain, you know, aspects of policing that people don't see, you know, generally. But on the other hand, he's trying to have a reasonable tone. I think it's a smart move on his part to say that, you know, we as law enforcement people, you know, we adhere to the law, and we want the process to play out, you know, and we hope that that people who are critical of what happened here will do the same. And I think that's the signal he's trying to say, that he is not over the top defending his people, and he is asking the public to take a similar posture. I think it's a smart move on his part.
I want to take another question now from Nolika in Brooklyn. Nolika, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Nolika, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I have two questions, but my first is around how they determine whether or not they can charge with a hate crime. I know you said that it would be highly unlikely to be charged with murder, but this idea that, you know, there's, like, some sort of negligence around there being, like, a hate crime, how does a grand jury determine whether or not that can be charged?
Nolika, thanks for your question. Murray Weiss?
No, I would say that it would be a hate crime if there was some evidence that the police decided to arrest Mr. Garner and there were use of, you know, racial epithets, you know, while, you know, let's get the so-and-so, and they went after him with where there's an element that would demonstrate that these officers were trying to arrest him partly because of his race, not because he was allegedly selling Lucy's, and that they were giving him, you know, every opportunity to surrender to them, and then they make a decision like, you know, we are here, you know, we're supposed to arrest people for crimes, and what are we going to do? Just let them go home, which they could have done, obviously. But, you know, the police are empowered to take people into custody. So I think that would be the element that would play into it there.
I want to stay on this topic of the, you know, the racial element of this case, which is obviously huge. And play a clip, actually, of Police Commissioner Bill Bratton on the Brian Lehrer Show last week talking about this case. We'll hear Brian's voice first, asking him a question.
These incidents take place that cause community backlash over and over again in city after city after city.
You will always have them. They will never go away. That's the nature of lies, unfortunately. The idea is how you deal with them, how you try to prevent more of them from happening. But the reality is is that the nature of our society is that these events will occur. It's unfortunate that when they do occur, that in some instances they lead to violence, as they did in St. Louis, that because they, each of them is a opportunity to show that the systems that are in place, if allowed to proceed in their course, that oftentimes they will deal with the issues of concern.
Murray Weiss, it's really quite striking, I think, to hear the commissioner of the NYPD say that these kinds of things are always going to happen, that they're inevitable, and that all we can do is figure out how to respond to them. I wonder what your reaction is to that, and do you think that that captures the wider view within the police department?
Oh, well, the second part of that is a tricky question. I think the police commissioner Bratton was kind of being honest there. I mean, as long as you live in a world where people, you know, violate the law and you empower people to arrest those people and you try to have some order in your society, there's going to inevitably be incidents. You know, I've covered so many going back over the years, enormous tragedies, and all extraordinarily controversial and very sensational. I think he's being honest. I mean, I recall in the Stansbury case, a young boy was on a roof in Brooklyn and a police officer was on vertical patrols. He was white, and it's the dead of night, and that's his job, and he gets on the roof and he gets startled and his gun goes off and he kills a young teen. Now, did he do it on purpose? No, a grand jury decided, and he testified. You're going to have encounters where people are getting arrested and things aren't always going to work out. I mean, that's just the truth.
I want to switch gears from...
Oh, by the way, just to answer your second part about the police, you know, do they see that as an inevitable extension? You know, I think the police, you know, with rare exceptions, they prefer to have peaceful nights on patrol, you know, but they have a job to do, and I think they recognize that they're going to do things that are, you know, that may not work out. And depending on the climate in the city at the time, you know, they're going to have enormous problems of being second guessed and, you know, being arrested or indicted and tried, you know, and sometimes with good cause. And, And sometimes, you know, they go home after a tragedy. It's hard to believe, but, you know, some people don't believe that they, you know, it kind of upsets their life and they're not, you know, they're sorry that these events occurred. But that's that is an aspect of the nature of their jobs.
I do want to touch on the stop and frisk numbers that have just come out, because I you know, one of the, I think, ideas behind Mayor de Blasio's promise to reduce stop and frisk was that maybe we could reduce the number of confrontations that possibly end violently. We have these new numbers. Could you actually just take us through, like, how much has the stop and frisk tactic decreased since last year, and how big a deal is it?
Well, the answer to that question, it has virtually stopped in New York by comparison to where it was. I know you weren't the host that I was on with Brian a year or two ago, where I published some stories that showed not only how many stop and frisk there were in New York, but what impact, which was nil, on the number of shootings in New York, that there was no correlation between these enormous numbers that had gone from 100,000 when Mr. Bloomberg took office, and that was kind of the number through the 1990s, to nearly 700,000 in 2011. I had a story a couple of days ago that said the number of stop and frisk in New York during the second quarter was like 13,000, coming off of a first quarter of 14,000. So there were 27,000 stop and frisk so far this year in the first half of the year. Last year alone, when this is after they already plunged from 700,000, they were down to like 190,000 last year. And now you're at a pace to have about 55,000 stop and frisk in this city. Crime is still very low. Crime has come down in this city. So, you know, the sad part of the stop and frisk story is that the New York City Police Department deserved an enormous amount of credit over a 20-year period of time of bringing crime down in this city. And I must say, spending the resources in the communities that had the biggest crime and bringing that down to the levels of the most affluent parts of this city, that, you know, the people could walk the streets of what were once, you know, urban wastelands and feel as safe as they might on Park Avenue here in Manhattan. However, these aggressive policies now have created the kind of issues that the police department faced probably 30 years ago, a sense that they were a invading police force, that they were needlessly arresting and stopping people in communities, particularly communities of color. The only advantage that New York has, as I indicated, is that to a large degree they've managed to remove or tamp down the race issue over the years, but that now has come back to the fore.
Well, and of course, I you know, should point out that I think there are a lot of opinions out there about what degree police tactics had to do with the dramatic drop in crime, which of course happened in New York and across the country, and how much larger forces that were operating economically, et cetera, across the country, you know, had to do with that. You know, since you were saying that you had done some reporting a year or two ago showing that there was no correlation between the number of stop and frisks and the reduction in violence, now there are people pointing out that as stop and frisks have plummeted over the last year, there's been a rise in shootings, I think 12% rise in shootings compared to the same period last year, and are trying to make a connection between those two things. Would you say that if there was no connection between the stop and frisks and the reduction in violence, there's no connection between the reduction in stop and frisk and the rise in shootings?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that the you know, stop and frisk is a part of policing. I think the issue was, you know, what impact it was having on shootings and other types of crime. And clearly, having stop and frisk is a tool that helps tamp down or control certain criminal behavior. I think the issue now is we're back to, you know, the kind of numbers and even below numbers in the 1990s. But crime isn't at 1990 levels. Crime is down, you know, to historically low levels. So maybe the stop and frisk numbers have come down to where they should be. And there are people who argue that. The question is, have they fallen to an appropriate level, or have they fallen a little too far? And whether, you know, we're at a tipping point here or an inflection point where many things in life are pendulum swing one way too far and then they swing the other way too far. And are we swinging a little too far in another direction? So I think it has a role here. It's just a question of is it the right number now? Should it go back up a little bit? Obviously, I'm in the camp that, you know, we're sort of more in the right arena again. And, you know, you made a point before. I was kind of singing a little bit of the praise of the police department for the crime reductions here in the city. But I've for a long time have been saying for many, many, many years that the communities played a tremendous role in the crime reductions in their neighborhoods as well. There's no denying that that from the pulpits and the civic leaders and the people and the economy that the crime reduction success in New York obviously has a number of factors to it.
And last question for you, Murray Weiss, criminal justice editor at DNA Info. There's council member Jumaane Williams announced an expansion in this gun violence crisis management system recently, which I suppose could be seen as kind of a better replacement, if you will, for stop and frisk in terms of getting gun violence down. Do you know anything about that system and what other tactics the police department is planning on implementing to keep gun violence down or reduce it even further?
Well, from the police point of view, they're of the opinion that the people who are using guns are the people we should go after. And in fact, that's what the police department used to do like 30 years ago when they had street crime units. They had very highly skilled police who could tell who was carrying guns in areas where there was a lot of gun violence, and they were very successful at it. I think the administration now wants to target gangs. They want to target drug dealers. These are the people who have weapons. These are the people who are using weapons, and they're the ones who are driving any kind of spikes in crime. So, you know, to get away from stopping and frisking everybody. You know, we don't need to do that. The criminals who are out there are the ones who are going to get the guns and try to use it. So let's be a little more laser-focused on them. As for Jumaane Williams and the mayor, you know, they're trying to come up with new ways to try to intervene with the kind of people who might be involved in gangs and might want to carry guns. So, you know, they're trying to do violence interrupters and have some people more in a social work, conversational way to get people to kind of diffuse potential violent acts before they occur. I mean, anything that helps keep somebody from getting a gun and shooting somebody and forestalling that, you know, you deter the anger, you diffuse the anger at the moment, and perhaps it'll bring down the shootings. But, you know, the number of shootings in New York and the kind of people who do shoot one another, that sort of stuff is a little, you know, classroom good. But I think maybe on the streets, some of the people I talk to are a little more skeptical of that.
Well, Murray Weiss, criminal justice editor at DNA Info, thanks so much for being with us and taking us through some of these things.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I do want to note that tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about Saturday's protest march in Staten Island around the death of Eric Garner. And we'll be taking your calls, those of you who are planning to attend and have thoughts on that. We want to hear from you. So we'll be talking about that on the program tomorrow. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, sitting in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, we'll look at the militarization of police across the country, what it means in Ferguson, Missouri, and beyond. Stay tuned.